kids. Bat Segundo here, and I really don't know the worst thing that I've ever done. There was the incident at a bar involving a nun and a $50 bill. There was the time in which I confused the door of the Argentine embassy with the door of a bathroom, followed by my accidental arrest and the charges of sedition that took 3 years to clear up. There was the moment in which I asked an attractive young woman if she wanted to go upstairs, and I got lucky, but I woke up the next morning and it turned out that she was my sister, or claimed to be my sister, I really don't know. Needless to say, this caused a good deal of expensive therapy and permanent emotional scars, but I'm sure that other people have done worse things than I have. I'm sure Ursula Heggie has done worse things than I have too, but as our young roving correspondent learned, they may not be as bad as one thinks.
Okay, so I'm here with Ursula Heggie, who is most recently the author of The Worst Things I've Done, and also is the author of Stones from the River. Ursula, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for inviting me to do this.
Oh, thanks for being on. I've been wanting to talk to you for a while. First off, I actually wanted to talk about the idea of Annie as a collage artist. It would seem to me that this book is, in a certain sense, kind of a collage of perspectives. Is having that kind of a vocational occupation, reflecting what the book form is about, was this something that you kind of had in mind with this? Or?
It's something that emerged. I mean, I never start out knowing what it's going to be, but it emerged very much that the book became a collage. Different voices, different points of view coming together. And, of course, Mason's voice coming in and out and in and out, you know, like a pulse. And that was something I was after.
When did you know that Mason's suicide note would kind of have this form in the actual book? And there's always a dash that precedes each particular Mason intervention. Yeah. And also, we can maybe talk about the italics. I'm sorry to throw so many questions at you at once, but we are pressed for time. So.
All right. Okay. First of all, it's not a suicide note. It's Mason's stream of consciousness.
Oh, okay.
He is there in Annie's studio. She has left. And he wants to destroy something that matters to her. And these are his thoughts and actions and memories during the last hour of his life.
Okay, okay. That's interesting. Well, how did the italics come about, since Mason is a rather sort of chatty, emphatical sort of presence in this book for all the character perspectives?
You mean the different print in his sections?
Yeah.
When I see the Mason chapter first, was all the Mason passages were one chapter. Mm-hmm. And I wanted it everywhere in the book. And I tried it in the beginning, I tried it in the middle, I tried it at the end, and it needed to be there everywhere. Mm-hmm. And then I, you know, after probably 50, 60 drafts, I thought, okay, I'm going to have it come in like a pulse. And I separated the chapter then. It changed, of course, a lot. But it never begins and it never ends. That's why the dashes are there. And if you were to read it without the other chapters, it would be Mason's voice. But it's sort of a haunting, in a way, a haunting of the book, that this voice keeps coming in again and again. And where the other characters really... You have what they're experiencing now and their flashbacks with Mason. You're there with him in that last hour of his life.
Some of the italics that are in the other chapters, were these originally in this big chunky sort of Mason?
Well, I use italics to do stream of consciousness.
Yeah.
And in Mason too, there are some stream of consciousness. There are italics within the different type.
Why do italics work as a stream of consciousness better than, say, another thing? There's also, of course, the sort of crazy, almost childlike font and everything flush right with Mason's stream of consciousness, as well as also the protest signs actually use a variation of that font or a close font and actually have this bolded, you know, so it kind of looks sort of somewhat absurd. So I'm wondering how that kind of came about.
I did that actually when I was writing the book. I wanted the other chapters, you know, fill the page and they start off with the beginning and... an ending, you know, they start on top of the page. But Mason's voice, I wanted to show, I wish you could see all the hand gestures I'm doing as I'm talking.
That's okay, I do a lot too. So
well, know. just, I'll describe it. I'm doing a lot of hand gestures. I wanted the Mason chapters, the Mason voice, this pulse, to just sort of come in at the edge of it. okay? I mean, a lot of the book is about living along the edge and crossing a border. And so visually, when I was working on it, I had a different font. And I placed it on the page, just half of the page, and started it very low at the bottom. And Simon Schuster was great in working with me at finding just the right font.
Were there arguments?
No, there were no arguments. There were more sessions like, for example, they sent me quite a few different options. Oh, okay. And we found the one in there that actually slants a little bit to the left, mm-hmm. I really liked.
Because I know people, some typography people can be really, really very adamant about certain choices, you know?
No, they've been great. And once, let's see, the first, what actually happened was the manuscript that I sent them on a DVD, or no, I actually emailed it. It lost all the pagination, and it lost all the margins. So it came through with all the same font. And then once we talked about it, you know, and I worked with them on it, and it was great. I thought it was very inventive, actually, the font that they came up with.
In terms of, I mean, I don't want to just talk about font and design, because
I didn't think we would.
Yeah, exactly. But the notion of living on the edge and the family in this, I was curious, because it's a very unusual situation in the sense that here you have a really amazing sort of birth of a baby, and you also have these characters determined to exist as a family unit from being childhood pals all the way to, you know, sort of later in life until unfortunate events happen. So it seems to me that there is this kind of juxtaposition of a sort of monogamous model that's a little loose in some sense versus this tendency of people to kind of clash together. Why do these characters feel the need to kind of, I guess, constantly sort of connect together throughout this book, or constantly sort of make this decision to remain a unified, or even a contentious unified whole?
Mm-hmm. Well, the three of them, Jake, Annie, and Mason, grew up in the same neighborhood.
Yeah.
And when they're children, I mean, they've known each other since, one person said, since before the womb even, or in the womb, since before birth. The friendship that they have when they're little kids, Annie thinks of it as golden, magical. And she thinks how close they were. You know, she thinks of, it was almost, especially with Mason, it was not even like two people, but a boy-girl kind of being. They love each other, you know, with an innocence when they're little. And as they get older into their teenage years, and especially to where the most of the action takes place in their mid-20s, the friendship turns dangerous.
Yeah.
Destructive, and they cross a line that, and here's this thing with the edge again, a line that was always there, and as soon as they were teenagers, they were aware of that line, but they always knew how far to go and how far not to go, and the book is about how they missed, not only about that, but it's about how they missed the moment when they could have still turned back.
Yeah.
You know.
I'm also curious, though, it also plays around with this notion of the nuclear family in the sense that Annie's parents die, there's a baby that then resurfaces and they become sort of surrogate parents. There is also Aunt Stormy, who is actually not an aunt, but a very kind of close kinship. So why this kind, these are very perverse, melodramatic sort of takes on the notion of family. So why did you feel the need to have these really sort of grand, extraordinary sort of events to form the basis of how these characters mesh?
It's where the characters took me.
Huh.
I mean, I really follow the characters. When I have a first draft, it's sort of the difference between a first draft and like perhaps I do between 50 and 100 drafts. And my final draft is the difference between a one-night stand and a long-term marriage. You know each other in a much, much more complex way. And the characters, when I first get to know them, you know, it's layer by layer by layer, which again has to do with the collage thing too.
Yeah.
And I follow them where they take me. I had no idea that they would live with Aunt Stormy, okay? I had, what I had in mind was, I had taken some notes in Spain when I was traveling with my husband in Spain in the early 90s. And there were three, we were at a castle above Granada. There were three teenagers, late teens, And their relationship was very, I was sort of alarmed by it and at the same time very curious. The woman was kissing one of the men and he backed her against the wall that was just about waist high and bent her back and the other men watched.
Yeah.
And then, you know, that scene is in there now. And then the woman turned the man, the man she was kissing around and pressed him against that wall. And I wrote that down and didn't know whatever would come of it. And then at a later point, much late, 10 years later, I was riding my bicycle through a little town and kids were having a lemonade sale. Same dynamics, Ed, same dynamics.
Interesting. Well, there's also something very curious about, for example, there's the moment where Aunt Stormy kisses the shoulder blades of Annie. Between the shoulder blades.
She touches her shoulder blades, and Annie remembers that this is where Mason used to touch her.
Yes, exactly. And this seems to me a really remarkable kind of palpable memory. And I'm wondering, this sort of extreme sensitivity of the physical, was how did this kind of manifest itself?
That's there in all my work.
Yeah.
I mean, the characters, they, just as you and I do, we live in a world where we... you know, the sensuous details, you know, what something smells like, what something sounds like, what something tastes like. The texture of this table is different than the texture, I won't touch it, of the microphone. And it needs to be authentic. And I really, I work on that.
Yeah. So, like, for example, the flooding, is this more of an environmental detail, or does this work as a kind of additional imagery that one can kind of detect some certain metaphorical subtext?
I never go for a metaphor, but the flooding, it was pretty much, once I have the characters, they really take me to those places. Okay, for example, when I was a little girl, I lived by near the Rhine River, and it flooded a lot. And one of the memories, personal memories, that came in for me as I was writing the book is my father saying, "We can drive through this flood." And he did it. He did it. And so, but it's a whole different, all different details, different characters. But that's where, you know, the detail then comes Mason driving through the flood and they find the house.
Yeah,
but, how
does a detail like, say, a kayak kind of enter the equation? I mean, you say the characters take you there, but certainly there's the environment that's going to take you there as
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely, and I'm a kayaker. Uh-huh. And I try to be near water as much as I can. You know, I walk, I swim, I kayak. So some of the critics have talked about the symbolism of water in all my work, and to me, water is water is water. It's what I'm surrounded by. Mm. And so things from my personal life certainly come in there, but it's never the story. It's more the feeling of, one thing I'm going to read tonight is about the Lumis, you know, those walnut jellies that lighten up the bay at night. I've seen that, yes, but I'm not the one experiencing it with the characters. So Faulkner once said that in strong fiction there are three, he said, imagine a building, on top of the building are three collectors. First one is experience. Second one is imagination, what you push or where you're drawn. And the third one is the subconscious, where afterwards you wonder, where the hell did that come from?
Yeah.
And when you're inside the building, and you turn on the water, you don't know where it came from.
So for something like water, it seems to me that this is more of an intuitive choice. I mean, you say...
It's a good way of putting it, yeah.
I mean, but I'm wondering, though, in terms of this subconscious idea of not a metaphor kind of manifesting later by reader interpretation or even your own reinterpretation. I mean, you've seen 50 to 100 drafts by this point. What do you do to make a kind of image potent or multiple meanings, or is it just a matter of just kind of knowing that it is absolutely right?
No, I never feel anything is absolutely right. It also may change in the with each revision. For example, for a long, long time I had no idea where Jake was when Mason killed himself.
Yeah.
And that came to me when I realized that, I thought, yes, yes. I always thought that quite likely Jake would have to tell Annie what he saw. And it surprised me when when he decided not to.
Yeah.
It also led more into, instead of, I don't like endings that close off a novel. I like to write endings that suggest a direction. And a lot of my readers have talked about my characters beyond the frame of a book. And when I read, too, that's what I like to find in books.
Now, the name Mason, it sort of connotes many possibilities. I mean, is it a Masonic handshake, or is he kind of a Mason in his own right in terms of trying to kind of manipulate people? I mean, sort of an art of emotional masonry, I suppose. Does a name like this, what causes a name like that to land itself as the definitive character name for you?
It was something I knew from the beginning. Jake's name kept changing. I would say to my editor, Mark Gompers, I'm on this passage with Jess now. He said, who is Jess? This was prior to Jake. It needs to feel right for the character, and somehow for this, Mason was there from the beginning. Annie was there pretty early, the name. The names sometimes change too, because they just need to, on an intuitive level, fit the characters.
If you are working on an intuitive level and you're writing 50 to 100 drafts, why so much vacillation?
Vacillation?
Or wavering in terms of constant revision. Does that kind of create the tension to create a novel? Or?
Well, first of all, in terms of tension, there needs to be material. There needs to be tension between me and the material. Otherwise, I wouldn't write the book. And for me, the revision really takes me deeper and deeper into who these characters are. And whatever happens to them comes out of who they are. Okay, for example, if you and I had a conversation about current politics and two people out there had the same subject, the conversation would be very, very, conversations would be very different because of what we bring to it. What we were afraid of at age 3, what we really wanted when we were 11. And so I need to know the characters before I really know what happens to them. So I keep writing through the book. And if I find something, for example, with Annie and Mason, page 200, it changes everything before that.
Yeah. So really it's a matter of finding a detail, and this causes the revision for you then.
Knowing the characters in a much deeper way. I'll give you an example. My novel, Emma Blau, The Vision of Emma Blau, took me a long time to write. And I actually finished several novels while it was sitting there, for 8 years. And after 8 years, I realized, I understood that one of the characters, Tobias, was gay. Mm-hmm. I had no idea until then, but that was the missing piece. And after that, I understood his relationship with his father in a much deeper way. And of course, that changed a lot of stuff, too. It's like knowing someone, one of your friends, maybe an early friend, up to a certain moment, and then realizing, oh, there's just much more to that person. And also knowing that as we know each other, as we get to know much more about each other, and then there are the dynamics now.
So you are not a person who likes to deal with an outline or to plan in advance. For you, the planning kind of comes instantaneously through constant revision.
Well, any given day, I will start off reading what I've written the day before or several days before, and that could be 40 or 50 revisions. And out of that then comes maybe a sentence, maybe 5 pages of new material, and that in turn then becomes what I read the next day.
But then for choices like Pete's speaking style, where he has this very particular ellipses, pause, I mean, how does something like that come about? When did you know, for example, that Pete was going to be speaking this way?
I knew Ann Stormy would have a lover. That came very early. I went into a friend's studio to make a collage, to learn how to make a collage, and she showed me that she rips a lot of the paper with dental instruments. And out of that came Pete's occupation. I have Annie use dental instruments, and so where did the dental instruments came from? Okay, Pete could be a dentist, but he isn't working right now. He had a stroke, and he's recovering, reclaiming his body. It evolves.
Gotcha. The wartime metaphors in this, there you have Aunt Stormy being a particularly politically aware person. Mm-hmm. You have, we discussed earlier, the run-ins with various protesters. How did this come about? Did you feel that this was kind of a way to buoy this into contemporary events, that this was as much of an important part of the story as this interesting dialectic about what the family unit is?
It has more to do, or it has to do with the world they live in. And a lot of my novels are political. You know, Stones from the River was set against the political reality of Germany between 1915 and 1952. And these characters live on Long Island. And it's not, I mean, we don't live in a vacuum. We do live within the political reality and the impact of that reality. So Aunt Stormy does protest against the unlawful invasion of Iraq and the manipulation of fear.
Now, the tribe of the barefoot women, that seemed to be a very definite metaphor there. So wait, you just told me earlier that you weren't into metaphors.
I don't. I certainly know what a metaphor is, and I can afterwards see certain things in my novel, you know. But I tell a story. I sit at my desk with people I make up inside my mind, and spend a lot of time with them every day. It is, I think, in fiction, it is telling a story and getting to know the character so well that I understand their story.
I was also curious about the ice queens that Jake is dating. How did this come about? The water situation?
I don't even know, but I know that the nasty fortune cookies are part of personal experience. Going to a restaurant once, in the Bronx with Gordon, and instead of getting the regular fortune cookies, we got some that were like, you know, you're totally incompetent and you will never amount to anything, sort of along that line.
Really? Where is this place? I was curious.
It's under an overpass, that's all I know.
Huh. That's probably somewhere.
it is.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I actually wanted to talk to you about the confusion of the peace sign with the Mercedes-Benz symbol. Mm-hmm. It's almost as if this, we're talking about these characters being on the edge, and yet there's also, seems to me, a kind of confusion in semiotics with this particular moment, as if they can't even faithfully reproduce the sort of cultural semiotics that they're supposed to kind of adhere to. What of this? Is this kind of playing again with this notion of the edge, or are all these characters essentially kind of confused, living in a miasma, or what?
I saw it more that this person who showed up at a protest, where there were a lot of people who'd been protesting for years or even decades, you know, against other wars. And he wants to protest, and he's there in a very well-meaning way, but he's turned the peace sign upside down, okay?
Yeah.
And someone tells him, you know, that's the Mercedes-Benz logo, and he's terribly embarrassed.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there are other parts of activism. You also note that the comparison between Bush and Hitler is just really unacceptable, and yet it constantly comes up. I mean, is this a matter of just really wanting to reflect? I mean, what did you use for the model of the political discourse of these activists and Aunt Stormy?
I don't think I used a model for that. I mean, I'm politically very aware and involved, and I was born in Germany, and I grew up with the shame of coming from a country where millions of people were murdered. And living in this country, I mean, I came in 65, and I always had such a strong belief in freedom of speech. I have seen the beginnings of, like, the manipulation of fear, the restriction of free speech. I have seen it in this country. I never thought I would.
Yeah.
So saying, you know, Bush is like Hitler is just doesn't work. Okay, they're not the same. But what's very, very close is how it began in Germany. Okay, with people's rights being limited, people agreeing to having their rights limited in order to feel protected. One person saying, "Only I can protect you."
But does a novel, is that intended to be a sort of way for people to think about these particular problems? I mean, is what is the, how much politics can one include in the novel and preserve, I guess, the form? Or is there really no form? Are there really no rules? I mean, certainly your work is really about breaking the rules.
It's like sex in a way, because if I read about two characters who are having sex and I just don't believe that it's within them, that attraction to each other or whatever, if it's there for the reader, it doesn't work. It needs to be there from within the characters, like violence, like politics, like swimming out into the ocean. It needs to come from character. I don't write to teach. I don't write to communicate. I write for myself. And I would keep writing, as I did for a long time, even if no one read me.
Now, in terms of the characters, each of them have different voices. Some are in first person, some are in third person. Mm-hmm. In the case of Annie, there's something interesting where often a modifier will be placed at the beginning, and then that will actually begin the sentence, or it will be repeated in the course of the next sentence. So how did some of these sorts of stylistic vernaculars come about in the course?
You're very observant. You read it very closely. Since I have several different points of view, they need to sound different. Okay, for example, in Stones from the River, I have an omniscient narrator, so who also goes into the perspectives of individuals, but the voice there is it's the same voice throughout the book. And here the different characters are telling what happened, so their voices need to be different. When I write something that's said in the present tense, the character is experiencing it at that moment. It gives it an immediacy. When I write, choose the past tense, it's a more reflective voice. The character already knows how whatever he or she is telling about came about. Yeah. And it's part intuitive and part really knowing, not in the first draft, certainly, but what I'm going for.
Yeah. So it really is the revision that allows these particular vernacular. I mean, basically, you are just a stylistic person, and the only way you can affect this style is really just heavy revision.
I don't know if I would describe myself like that, Ed. I think there is something odd about writing, okay? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's when I was a kid, I always wanted to write. I wanted to write since I was five years old. And I used to do it, even if I knew no one else who wrote. And it was, sometimes it felt like a weird thing that I was driven to do. And I love that part of myself. And I feel very lucky that I am doing what I always wanted to do. But some of the things I can't explain. It's more, I know when I'm not writing, it's like part of me is not functioning. I mean, I love to teach too, but I could, you know, stop teaching, but I don't think I ever could stop writing. So I've talked with other writers about that too, and it's the way we're wired in a way.
Yeah. Is isolation a vital part of writing for you? Or when did you know, did you meet other writers that you knew were doing exactly the same thing?
It took me quite a while. I mean, as a kid, I was always reading and writing poetry, started a novel on lined paper, terribly gloomy teenage poetry walking along the Rhine River.
Most teenage poetry is gloomy.
I know, yeah. I know. I really didn't get to meet other writers sort of at the same level of exploring their writing until I went to the University of New Hampshire. I didn't know you could study writing. And at UNH, I met other writers, and we read each other's work, and it was even more helpful than what we learned in the classes. I mean, all of it came together. The classes were great, but reading each other's work in addition to that, and meeting, you know, like at Nick's in Durham, New Hampshire, and talking about our work, we really learned a lot from each other.
I'm wondering if how much the actual process of writing is learned from heavy reading or heavy revision. How much would you say is helpful towards you? I mean, clearly your particular approach requires a good deal of revision. So I'm wondering, in terms of reading, how this pertains to the act of generating.
I don't know if you heard this quote by Kafka, but he once talked about a book has to be the axe for the frozen sea within us. And those are the books I love to read. And those are the books I write. When I'm reading, the best reading is when I forget I'm turning pages, when I'm inside the characters. And it's like being at the theater and forgetting that you're sitting in a darkened room, you know, looking at a stage. You're up there on that stage inside the characters. And that's what I go for in my writing too. For example, to write from Annie's point of view, I need to become Annie. To write from Opal's point of view, I need to be 9 years old. To write from Trudy Montag's point of view in Stones from the River, I am her height. I feel her rage. I feel her bliss. I cannot write about feelings unless I go there with the characters. So sometimes I sit at my desk blushing, smiling, close to tears. But I do have to become each character. It's like method acting.
Yeah. Interesting. I mean, do you have any theatrical background?
No. But I write about method acting when I was in my 30s, and I thought, but that's what I've been doing in my writing. And then I read a lot more about it because, I wanted to learn more about it, and I did.
Gotcha. Well, I know you have to get going, but Ursula, thank you so much for talking. It's a pleasure having you.
Wonderful questions, Ed. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
A cigarette that bears a lipstick's traces, an airline ticket to romantic places, and still my heart has wings. These foolish things remind me of you. A tickling piano in the next apartment, those stumbling words that told you what my heart meant, a fairground.